Opal Dockery talked to Mike Spa for StoryCorps back in 2010. Opal was 96 at the time, and Mike was 37. The two friends met when Mike worked in the St. Louis Center for Seniors here in Kansas City. Opal was a resident there. During their conversation, Opal tells Mike a lot of really funny, lighthearted stories from back in the day. How she met her husband, things like that. But then this happens.
What would you say would be your happiest moment that you've had so far?
My happiest moment? You mean in my life?
One of your many happy moments. Let's go that way.
Right now. Right now, doing just what I'm doing.
Sharing your history?
Yes. Well, maybe it's because if I can just help one person, just one, in some special way, I'd be satisfied with that. I don't want to say that I've lived all of these years and didn't do anything for anybody, but I question myself sometimes. I do wonder if there's anything I have done for anybody that has cheered them or helped them on their way. But I've tried.
Well, I can tell you've done that for me.
Thank you.
You've done that for me. You've filled a void in my life, not having a grandma.
Thank you.
And you've been that.
Thank you. I love it.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today, as StoryCorps heads back to town, I am determined to find out what crazy spell they cast in that Airstream trailer to make a simple conversation the happiest moment in someone's life, and to guarantee that people all over the country will be crying in their cars on a Friday morning. Joining me now on KCUR's Central Standard is Jacqueline Van Meter. She's the site manager for the whole StoryCorps mobile program. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hey, Gina. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me today.
Do moments like the one we just heard still make you cry?
Absolutely. Every single time. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I cried no less than 3 times in 10 minutes yesterday getting ready for this show.
I believe it.
I'm sure that a lot of our listeners, like probably most of them, are familiar with StoryCorps, but some may be new to it. So why don't you sum it up real quick? What is StoryCorps?
Sure. So we've been doing this work since about 2003, but we think of ourselves as kind of this oral history and storytelling hybrid project. So in practical terms, that means that our teams move around the country, we collaborate with different communities and community organizations, and we set up recording days where all different members of that community can come in and sit down and record an uninterrupted 40-minute conversation with someone that they care about from their life, whether that's a grandmother or a surrogate grandmother or a friend, a colleague, a relative, a spouse, whomever. And they can talk about whatever they want. There's no right or wrong way to do it. The idea is really for us to just give them a space to record the things that matter to them, you know, whether that's recording histories from their family or simply just a conversation they've never had before. And then at the end of that 40 minutes, our participants have the option, if they like, to have that conversation archived in our collection, which is preserved at the Library of Congress, where to date we have something to the tune of 76,000 conversations from across the United States archived in our collection. So it's, in a sense, our way of trying to create this sort of oral history of the United States that captures not just the stories and the histories of communities, but something about the dynamics and the relationships that we have in our lives as well.
So when did you get involved, and what is it exactly that you do?
Oh, I'd say I got involved in 2008 when I started listening to StoryCorps and fell completely in love. But I didn't start working here until the fall of 2016. We have a number of different ways that we go about collecting interviews. One, of course, is the mobile tour. We also have a couple of kind of brick and mortar story booths, one of which is in the Atlanta area at the Atlanta History Center. So shout out to the Atlanta Story Booth. That's where I got my start. And I made my way through a couple of different teams as a facilitator, traveling around the country and recording stories. And I joined the mobile tour in April of 2018, so just a few months ago. And it's been really exciting. And
it must of course, I just want to say it must be a really interesting way to see the country. Like, you're on a big road trip, basically, but you're also kind of set up to meet people and hear the most intimate conversations in some cases that they've ever had.
Exactly. Gina, it's a job like no other. I mean, I had this experience on a previous team. I would go for maybe 3 or 5 days, and I'd always try to sign up for the longest trips I could, because I found that the more you hear conversations, of course, you're seeing this sort of intimate glimpse into people's lives, but they also so often talk about the way that the place that they live, the community that they live in, shapes kind of who they are and what their experience of their life has been. And so the longer I was in town, the more that I could sort of connect the dots of hearing what mattered to people. And then, you know, in my downtime, I'd run out and go and try to get a sense of it myself. And so when the opportunity to join the mobile tour, where I was just fully immersed for the year, came up, I jumped at the chance.
So how long have you been, how far into that process are you? Because it's a 1-year position, right?
That's right. It's a 1-year position. We fill it every April. So I went on the road starting in April. That was in Fort Collins. So we did 5 weeks there. 5 weeks in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. We're finishing up now our fourth, fifth week or so in Bismarck, North Dakota, and then we are headed to Kansas City. So
you've been
excited.
On like a Western tour. What have you been learning about this part of the country that you've seen so far as you've been out there collecting people's stories?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is just how unique and distinct each community is. You know, I thought, the West, it'll be great. Colorado and then Wyoming, it's all going to be one big sort of Western adventure. But in fact, my experiences in Fort Collins and in Jackson were quite different. You know, in Fort Collins, there was, you know, just this very like public radio friendly, super liberal leaning, you know, very progressive attitude. And that existed in Wyoming as well, in Jackson specifically. But of course, Jackson is quite different than the rest of the state. So, you know, just getting a sense of each community and sort of what their values are, you know, what their approach to documenting history is even was really interesting. You know, I think here in Bismarck, for example, people really value the idea of telling the history of Bismarck and the history of North Dakota. But there's a real modesty here and a hesitation on the part of a lot of folks to want to be the person to grab the microphone and, in a sense, sort of feel like they're standing on a soapbox and tell their story. So, you know, we think of StoryCorps as this like really wonderful, sweet opportunity, but it means something different to different communities. And that's been a really interesting discovery as we move from stop to stop.
So how does it work up close? This is what I picture because I've never seen it in action, and I know that this can't be right. I picture people standing in line outside this trailer 2x2 in little pairs, and then someone ushers them in the doors and they shut behind them. And then later the doors swing open and they've just been in this little cocoon by themselves, because it sounds like so natural and so personal that I cannot imagine a third party in the room. I know that this can't be right. Someone has to be facilitating things.
That's true, but you're pretty dang close, Gina. The only thing that's distinct is we usually don't have a line because, of course, people make reservations on the hour. And
they're not holding hands, I bet, because that's kind of part of my picture, too.
I mean, you know, anything can happen. We have a lot of good vibes around the booth. It's interesting. One of our goals as facilitators when we are in the space, we are that third person, is really to try to maintain the focus between the participants on each other. I mean, we're there to bear witness. We're there to create the conditions necessary so that those folks can really zero in on each other. And of course, we're there to make sure that this conversation is documented, right? So not only running the audio equipment and adjusting audio levels, but we're actually taking notes as well to create kind of a table of contents of the conversation. So if they do decide to archive, future generations not only have the audio, but they have a little roadmap to follow as well. But, you know, we're kind of doing that in our corner in the dark. Occasionally we ask a question or two, but as you'll see when we roll into town here in another week, the space really is, as you said, kind of like a cocoon, and the lights are low, the tissues are out, and we're really trying to create a space where the folks can 100% pay attention to each other and really intentionally listen.
You mentioned that you're there to bear witness. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think, you know, the idea of StoryCorps has evolved over the years, but one of the really fundamental tenets that is really very much at the fore of our priority now is giving people of all different backgrounds and beliefs the opportunity to tell their story and to really speak to their own history in their own voices and on their own terms. And for some people, you know, there's a long history of not being able to tell their history or have their history told from the perspective of the winners or, you know, just not their language and not their perspective. And so you know, it's important that we're sitting there, we're really holding space for these people to get out of the experience what they want. And you know, we're there to listen as well and make sure that it's documented. And so as much as we want to stay out of the way, we're also very active in listening and encouraging and making sure that our participants really own the space. So I think that's what it means to me.
When you are witnessing this process, do you learn something about people, like relationships, the human condition?
Oh, yeah. All the time, every day. You know, we see there's so many different kinds of pairs that come in. And of course, within each pairing, you know, not every husband and wife is alike. Not every grandparent and grandchild is alike. And one of the things that I think is the most gratifying aspect of this work is seeing people come in and, you know, I think that this has shown me you really can't judge a book by its cover. And I love being surprised by the way that people suddenly engage. You know, they'll be out at the beginning, people are kind of filling out paperwork and getting ready, and then the lights go low and we flip on the microphones and there's like an electricity in the room all of a sudden, and you just see people snap to attention and engage with one another. And within that, you know, frequency, there's just so many different ways in which people listen to each other, learn from each other. I love seeing people who've known each other for 40 years or 50 years or 70 years, you know, move each other, make each other cry, or discover things that they actually don't know about each other or they've never actually said directly to each other.
Well,
you know?
I think a lot. I mean, you can hear those moments where people suddenly, the conversation changes from when they've had before to when they haven't. You can hear it happening. I want to play another clip from one of the past stops here in Kansas City on that StoryCorps tour. This is Charmelle Wilson interviewing her mom, Susan Wilson. Susan is part of the family here at KCUR. She used to co-host a show here. But more significantly, she is now the Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Inclusion at UMKC. She and her daughter talked in the StoryCorps trailer in 2010, and we're going to pick up the conversation midstream. Susan's been talking about growing up biracial, and her daughter jumps in.
What I want to know is, though, tell me one thing about being biracial that you felt it was a positive, and maybe one thing that was a real true challenge.
Knowing something about both worlds, I was able to be a bridge. I was always able to understand the perspectives of two completely different groups of people. And I think it gave me a keen interest in learning about other people who were different. I think the negative thing was I felt often that I didn't fit in anywhere.
Definitely being your daughter and knowing the history, your history as well as Nene's history, which is Jean, my grandmother, I think it definitely has given me a different outlook on life, more so than I think many people that I've grown up with.
In what way?
Well, I think being a child or a grandchild or the product of an interracial relationship, I had no idea that my grandmother was white. No clue. And in fact, it wasn't until we moved to Topeka and I had someone say to me, "Do you have a maid? Who's that white lady that's always coming out of your house?" And I was offended. I was upset because I had no clue what they were talking about because she was Nene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she loved me and Justin and took care of us. She was just grandmother. She mm-hmm. wasn't this white lady. So first of all, I gained an appreciation, I think, just for pure love of people. And then secondly, I think watching your challenges and struggles, having been a single mom that raised two children, you know, you went on and got a PhD in psychology. I'm sorry. I now have a real true appreciation for dreams because I saw you achieve your dreams. I think I have just a true appreciation of being a woman and a mother.
And that is one of those three times I cried in 10 minutes yesterday. You know, Susan spends every day thinking about diversity, leading conversations about diversity. But you can tell that she and her daughter have never had this conversation this way with each other until now. Are you there, Jacqueline?
Yeah, sorry, I'm here. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, and this kind of dialogue happens all the time. You know, just these these moments of discovery or and I think a thing as well that can happen is even if people do speak to these sort of experiences, they often tell these stories about each other rather than actually sitting down and dialoguing to each other. And there's, you know, a big difference between, saying, my mom has been this example and has shown me what it means to be a bridge, and actually saying, you know, mom, you've been my example and you've shown me what it means. So just taking that time to actually dialogue back and forth to each other is, I think, what makes not only the experience of recording so powerful, but what makes folks like you listen to it later and really hear the depth of the emotion there.
You know, I mean, I feel like I do talk to the people in my life, but there are big subjects that maybe you need a special time and place to bring up, not because anyone's made them off limits, just because they're emotional and you don't spring that on someone on the way to the store or like over dinner. You know what I mean? I mean, part of it is probably the physical space and the making of that appointment.
Yeah, exactly. And we think that, you know, the microphone really gives people permission to ask those questions and to say, for example, you know, what are you most proud of, or what was the hardest time in your life? And yeah, you don't necessarily have those conversations on the way to the grocery store. And even if you do, you know, the difference, I think, with StoryCorps is there are no interruptions, there's no distractions. It's just the two of you having that dialogue and really listening to each other.
Well, if a StoryCorps story has stuck with you, tell us about it. What is it you carry with you? Or if there's a conversation you'd be maybe willing to have by appointment that you cannot imagine bringing up in the course of daily life, you can tell us about that too. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman talking to Jacqueline Van Meter with the StoryCorps Mobile Tour, headed to Kansas City next month. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Jacqueline Van Meter. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hey, Gina.
Jacqueline is the mobile tour site manager for StoryCorps, and we're talking about what makes those conversations between people so powerful. Jacqueline, I mean, the thing is, we could just set aside time to have these stories, like these conversations, without you guys coming to town. But since we often don't, I mean, do you think it is the goal of StoryCorps to get people doing this themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's not uncommon for participants, after they've had the experience of recording together, you know, as soon as we kind of hit stop and take a breath, oftentimes people look at each other and say, we should do that more. Let's set aside, you know, a coffee date every Friday morning and just have these conversations. And, you know, we, as much as it's a priority for us to kind of create that collection at the Library of Congress, that oral history, we're also, you know, very focused on trying to create a culture of listening and, you know, really promote the idea that if we take the time to really listen to each other more uninterrupted, that really important things can happen in the relationships that we have and then in the stories that we hear more broadly.
What is the role of that collection being at the Library of Congress?
Well, it actually kind of started. Dave Isay, who's our founder, you know, he from a very early age loved to record stories. And he actually, you know, I think on one holiday recorded conversations between his grandparents as kind of an adolescent. And later, he went looking for the recordings and he couldn't find the tape anymore. And it's been this sort of lifelong mission of him to find it. And so I think the idea was, not only would we give other people the opportunity to honor folks in their lives by asking questions and sitting down and recording these stories, but the preservation of the Library of Congress ensures that those stories will never be lost. And, of course, the other thing is that it's going to be such an incredible resource for folks in the future to go back 50, 100 years from now and be able to hear people telling the stories of their lives in an intimate way, in an intentional way, you know, kind of on their own terms. And it just gives us a more intimate glimpse into what life is like in these communities here in 2018.
Well, you still have just a little time to call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about conversations. Let's hear another story from Kansas City while we're waiting. This one aired nationally in 2006, and a lot of people who heard this conversation still remember it today. I did not hear it back then, but people have been telling me about it ever since. So I finally tracked it down, and it's no surprise it's a tearjerker. This is a conversation between a girl named Mary Warm. She was 15 at the time, and her dad, David Warm.
Mary, who is the most important person in your life?
My sister. I really look up to her, and she's a great person, no matter her room is messy.
Do you remember when you were young, and on Friday nights, you and your sister and I would dance in the living room? We'd take out the coffee table, and we'd turn up the music, and we'd get on our backs and be like bugs?
Yeah.
Is there something about me that you've always wanted to know, but you've never asked me?
Yes. Dad, how did you feel when I was born, and how did Mom feel?
Well, that's a complicated question. We didn't know we were going to have a little girl, so that's the first thing we thought. We were really pleased to have another little girl. And then when we learned you had Down syndrome, I think we both decided that we had to figure it all out. And so we went to classes, and we read books, and we talked to other people. But about 2 months later, I think we just kind of relaxed and realized we just needed to raise you with love and teach you like we did your big sister, and everything would turn out all right, and I think it has.
You tell me I'm special all the time. What makes me special?
Well, there's a lot of things that are special about you. You know, your mom and I, we both really admire you because you are so positive, because you work really hard for everything that you get, and you go out of your way to make sure that everybody's doing okay. Not everybody's like that. In fact, I told somebody just the other day that I want to be more like my daughter Mary when I grow up. Do you have other questions?
No, I don't. Back to you.
Back to me, huh? What one thing about me upsets you? I'm not sure I wanted to ask that.
If you, like, tell me exactly what to do.
So you don't like it when I raise my voice, huh?
Yeah.
Are there some things you want to ask me about you?
Yes. What is your goal for me?
What are Mom and my goal for you?
Yes.
Well, I hope most of all that you keep your sunny personality no matter what you do. And I hope you find somebody you love and have a family of in whatever way you have a family. And we're really looking forward to getting to know you as an adult because you've been such a great kid.
Thanks.
And just a quick update, Mary is 26 now. She's thriving. She lives independently in Brookside. She works at a preschool, and she's getting her associate's degree. She is also on the self-advocacy board of the National Down Syndrome Congress. So, Jacqueline, what jumps out to you in that conversation between Mary and her dad as someone who's heard a lot of these?
Oh, what a great story. I mean, there's such good questions. I love, you know, I think the questions are really honest, and you can tell that they're bringing their I don't know, just like best intentions to it, you know, asking. I appreciate the bravery, right, of course, of asking, like, what about me upsets you? I personally really love father-daughter conversations, and I think what jumps out to me as well is hearing her father, you know, recognize that he's gotten to know her as a child, and that they're equally excited to get to know her as an adult. I really love the panorama of that simple comment. I think that's really beautiful.
What is it that you love about father-daughter conversations?
I think I'm just really tight with my own dad. And so I really appreciate that relationship. I think there's a sweetness to it and a tenderness to it. I don't know. I think that I don't know. I think I just project because the one full 40-minute conversation that I've recorded at StoryCorps myself has been with my dad. He and I are really close, and so those stories just always resonate to me because I relate to them so closely.
What was that experience like for you? I mean, do you feel like something changed between you and your dad in those 40 minutes?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you don't end up at StoryCorps without being someone who's inclined to want to have deep dive conversations with everyone in your life anyway. So my dad and I are really close, and we have a lot of big conversations. But certainly the context of doing it at StoryCorps, you know, with those microphones brings a focus and brings an intention to it. And He's a musician, and we talked a lot about how music has become sort of a family member in our lives. And I think that, you know, he got emotional thinking about what it meant for me to sort of carry on musical tradition and to carry it forward, you know, sort of following his example. I don't think that I'd ever really gone there with him before. And yeah, you end up just thinking about like the future and future, you know, what the next generation is going to look like when you have these conversations. And that puts things into a perspective that can be very, very moving.
You know, you said something just talking about how close you were with your dad and how inclined you were to share anyway, but that this is still who you decided to come and do this with. And it strikes me that trust, like an existing level of trust, is probably a big part of what allows people to do this with someone in their life. Have you ever seen people who don't come in with that existing level of trust? I mean, is there that difference that you witness?
That's a great question. So the model for StoryCorps has really been bring in someone from your life that you care about. And, you know, I think people kind of follow in the examples of what they hear on the radio, you know, broadcasts like, you know, Mary and David, Opal and Michael, and they immediately sort of think of who in their life that they love would they want to bring in. But we also, you know, the model can work in a lot of different ways, and we have a number of initiatives at StoryCorps where we try to focus on documenting and amplifying the voices of particular communities. And an upcoming initiative that we're piloting this year is called One Small Step, in which we're actually bringing together combinations of folks who perhaps don't even know each other, but represent sort of different sides of the political aisle, and seeing whether or not this model of intentional conversation and asking people about their lives and the experiences that shaped them could actually be something of a bridge in terms of helping folks who come from different backgrounds and have different political positions, you know, to come to a place of understanding. So TBD on whether or not that works out. We've done a little bit of work with it so far.
I am curious about that, but what I'm really wondering here is, like, will you let people out before 40 minutes if it's not working? Or are they in it for 40 minutes?
No participant, regardless of kind of what their intention is in the booth, has to complete the full 40 minutes. It's their space for them to sort of use how they want. And, you know, we have folks who come in and say, I've got three stories I want to tell. It'll take me 20 minutes and I'm done. So we certainly don't hold anyone captive in that booth. You know, the goal is always to make sure that the participants feel like they have agency, that they're comfortable, and they're getting out of it what they want. So obviously with conversations like One Small Step, there's a lot of preparation in advance that goes into what are the participants' goals? What are they hoping to get out of it? You know, what is the establishing sort of ground rules and levels of respect and things like that? But yeah, you know, it
kind of matchmaking too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. We wanna make sure that that we're pairing folks whose goals are kind of aligned and that their curiosity sort of dovetails. So, but it's nuanced work, and we're just at the beginning of it.
So yeah, you said you've done a little work on it already. Can you share anything from that?
I think we have done it. I personally have not yet facilitated one. We've got a woman based in Brooklyn named Rosalind Almonte who's kind of heading up this project. And we have a team of folks in Brooklyn who are kind of dedicated to piloting these and experimenting them. And we definitely do them in collaboration with organizations that, you know, help us to understand the communities in which we're working and maybe can give us some suggestions on pairings. What I've learned so far is that, you know, it's not easy to have these conversations. And if you're going to go deep, you have to kind of get to know each other and figure out who you're talking to first. And so there's a fair amount of just, you know, politeness that happens in the first few minutes. But then eventually what we have found so far is that most folks find that they actually have more in common, even in terms of their beliefs, than they realized, and that their, you know, their political perspectives are kind of coming from sort of the same place, and they're not as different as they might have thought. And that's something we're really excited to see if we can continue to uncover.
This sounds very free to be you and me, and like I want to believe that this is what happens when you put people from opposite sides of a political spectrum in a booth together. But like, what is happening on the front end of that to make that possible? Because when people from different perspectives just randomly encounter one another, say on the internet, that is certainly not what usually happens.
Definitely not. Well, the anonymity of the internet, you know, tends to enable us bringing out our worst selves. And, you know, we like to think that the StoryCorps model does the opposite, and that when you're really looking someone in the eyes and you're talking face to face and really listening, which is the concept, that brings out our best selves and gives us a place to come from, which is, you know, rooted in a willingness to listen and to understand. And so in terms of the front end, for sure, we're looking for folks who are not on the extremes and are not looking to prove a point or to convince someone, but really that folks that have a genuine curiosity in trying to understand, you know, who are the human beings behind this position that I think of as in opposition to my own. And so that mutual curiosity is definitely what plants the seed for real discovery.
Jacqueline Van Meter with us from StoryCorps. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
StoryCorps is going to be recording local conversations at the Nelson August 2nd through early September. If you want to record a story, there is one more chance to get in on that starting August 3rd. Keep your eye on kcur.org for the info. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR's Central Standard continues in just a minute. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. The Wheatley Provident Hospital on 18th and Forest was Kansas City's first Black-owned hospital. It opened in 1918, and it's been closed since 1972. Since then, it has mostly sat empty. It was actually on a list the city keeps of dangerous buildings not too long ago. Well, you may have heard the news that someone bought it. The new owners want to restore the building and preserve its history, and we'll hear more about that in just a few minutes. But first, let's listen back to an interview I did last year with a guy who researched the history of the hospital for a website called Failed Architecture. Michael Adams put Wheatley Provident on our radar.
Wheatley Provident was a hospital that got its start through a need by the African-American community here in Kansas City to establish, I guess, better facilities. We're talking about, I want to say, between 1915 and 1920. The hospital had its roots, I guess, in several different area hospitals that came together to form one singular hospital.
So what was the need they were filling, as you call it? You know, you said that it was filling a need for the African-American community.
There was a hospital called, I think it was General Hospital Number 2, which was established by the city. That hospital was kind of full of graft. It was for African-Americans. General Hospital Number 1 was for the white populace. But like I said, General Hospital Number 2 had a lot of like graft. And so the African-American community here in Kansas City wasn't really getting the needed services that they required.
And so how does Wheatley Provident enter the picture?
Wheatley enters the picture circa 1915, like I said before, in the fact that it kind of stepped in and filled that need that General Hospital Number 2 did not establish.
Where is it and what does it look like today?
It's on 1826 Forest, and it is kind of like a big limestone L-shaped building. It's two stories tall, and it is completely dilapidated. The structure is still standing, like the limestone kind of outside of it. But if you kind of take a drive by it, which I'd recommend that everybody, you know, who's listening to this do, building, the door is open, actually can walk inside. Once you walk inside, you kind of look to your left and right, you see just trash, you know, strewn about. And if you kind of go up the steps on the second floor and kind of gaze to your right, you look up and see a giant hole kind of in the middle of the building.
What got you curious about it? I mean, the Central Standard team found out about this story from an interview you did with an online publication on failed architecture, mm-hmm. like a whole website dedicated to what they call urban failure. And this hospital is discussed on this website, tagged with the keywords ruin and dystopia. That is pretty bleak.
It is, yeah. I kind of came to the hospital through my kind of ancestry doing research on genealogy. I am related to my great grandmother. She did the fundraising efforts, you know, to get the hospital established. And so through her, that is kind of how I am related to this project. My friend Benjamin Bush, who is kind of doing architectural studies in Berlin, he's the one who contacted me about writing the article for Failed Architecture.
There's a detail in this article, I mean, the detail of the structure itself, that the words asylum still sort of hover over a part of this structure.
Yeah, in the 1980s, it was used as a haunted house attraction. And so they're the ones who put the asylum sign on the top of the, I think, the right structure.
There's the building's medical use, and then there's something about that that gets kind of twisted in like a fictional existence that this building has had, the purpose of which was to scare people.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, obfuscates in quite a really dramatic way the initial origins of the hospital, which was to fulfill a need in the African-American community. And so you see it later on being used to amuse people.
Why is this building in ruins?
After it was used, I think, as the haunted house attraction, there was no more usage for it for whatever reason, you know, within the community.
But why did it close originally? Why did it stop being a hospital?
The operations moved to Martin Luther King Medical Center, which I believe eventually became Truman Medical Center.
Do you, I mean, so this is as part, this is an article in a, now in a publication on failed architecture, or like subtitled just generally urban failure. Do you see Wheatley Provident as a failure?
Currently, I definitely do. You kind of want to make sure that you maintain historic structures like this. And in that way, I definitely do see it as a failure kind of on behalf of the city and, you know, some of the populace within the community that let that happen.
But what is it about its past that makes you want to commemorate it?
The significant amount of effort that the African-American community here in Kansas City put into it, I think, really requires that we pay deference to the building itself.
Tell me about that effort.
Like I was saying earlier, my grandmother, Clara Adams, it was my great-grandmother, she raised quite a bit of the funds to get that hospital, you know, the structure up, along with several other members of the community. There was the doctor who started the hospital. His name was John Perry. He was from Tennessee. He went to Meharry Medical School, and he was the one that initially identified the need for a private African-American hospital here in Kansas City. So you have, you know, all these disparate kind of geographic elements coming in to, you know, get this effort off the ground. And I think that is a story worth telling.
What do you know about the people who came there for treatment? Have you found any just like personal stories of what people experienced in this hospital or no?
I know a couple people. There's a gentleman who I'm in contact with. His father was a doctor there in the 1950s. My aunt, I think she was born there. And so the hospital is still quite a bit relevant to the community in that regard. I mean, you know, there's still a significant amount of people alive in Kansas City who have links to it. The pediatric ward at the hospital was one of a very like pioneering pediatric ward. I think it was the first of its kind in the Midwest. And then they also trained a significant amount of nurses. They had a nurse training school.
Why do you think that even though the building itself has essentially crumbled, you know, except for some stark remains, why do you think it's also kind of still there?
It's a good question. It hasn't been demolished now because it's on the Kansas City Register of Historic Places, excuse me. And so I think that has been really saving it from demolishment. There's also, if you, you know, kind of go online, you do a simple Google search, there's a significant amount of people who have had interest in this hospital over, you know, the last 20 years and are kind of wondering why nothing has been done with it.
With the story it tells, I would say it's literally in plain view on the city streets. Why haven't we heard more about Wheatley Provident, do you think?
I think kind of back to the point that we were getting to earlier with the haunted house thing, that definitely kind of obfuscated its historic presence. A lot of the members of the community who were around at the point in time when it was at its most prominent, those members have since moved on or have passed away, even though, you know, there are a lot of people who have memories of the hospital.
You talked about a doctor who worked there. I mean, this would have been a successful professional doing really, like, important work. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that there are stories in that, too, that need to be told? I mean, just the idea that there was in this community a hospital with successful physicians. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Vine Street was a whole community kind of unto itself. I mean, you know, in addition to a hospital, there was a high school. There were several kind of like local bars. There were places that you can go and dance. There was a movie theater. It was its own kind of self-contained area.
That was Michael Adams speaking to us about his research on Wheatley Provident Hospital on KCUR Central Standard back in March of last year. But now, good news for that building. I'm here with Erica Bryce, one of the people who just bought it. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
I am good. What is the plan for the Wheatley Provident building at 18th and Forest?
Well, we're still figuring out what the long-term plan is going to be. At this point, I think we've owned the building, this is the 24th, for 23 days. So it's been a fast and furious. Yes, it's been a fast and furious 23 days. Right now, our primary goal is to secure the property. As Michael said in the interview, it was open for some time and people could access it, and they did, and they still try to. But we've been successful with a great construction team who has boarded it up. It's been tagged several times already. We actually have a few holes from people trying to still break into the building.
Just because they were used to being able to, maybe? Or,
you know, and I'm not sure if the media attention has made people even more curious, but I think that could possibly be part of it, unfortunately.
Man.
Yeah, it's been tagged. I think we just got tagged again three or four days ago. Very bright colors, too. So yeah, but I mean, that's the primary thing. It is a dangerous building. It is not safe for the public to go into. So for anybody that's curious, feel free to drive by. But please do not go on the site. And my construction team would definitely tell you the same thing.
What does the building and its history mean to you and your partners on this project?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my partners, Shamari Benton and Michael Edmondson, it means a lot. You know, when we stepped into this, it was really from the idea of let's save this building. But then we also see potential in the area, quite frankly. Last night, I watched again this great documentary by Kevin Wilmot. And please do not quote me on the name, but I believe it's Separate But Equal, the story of Truman Medical Center. And it's on YouTube, 57 minutes, great history. And it enlightened it for me even more when you think about the time period when it was started, which is Dr. Perry and Dr. Unthank were both the children of people that were enslaved. So this period in time in history, and especially in Kansas City, Missouri, was a period of transition. They served to show that people of color could be doctors, that we could operate on our own, that we were educable. And they actually served to also teach people that were formerly enslaved as well. So the building is great, but it's the history and what really went into it, as Michael said, that really is the testament of what the building is.
So what is your timeline moving forward? I mean, I know that you're still figuring out exactly what you will do with mm-hmm. it ultimately, but there are some, I'm guessing, first steps just to get the building in a kind of shape where you can do anything at all.
Right. So we've already started on securing the building, getting it stabilized. That's the primary part.
What does that mean, stabilized?
So stabilized means a lot of different things. It's really just trying to make sure that it doesn't deteriorate any further. So of course, getting the building sealed up is primary to that. There are some roof issues. I've actually seen a drone video that the KC Star did, so I could see where some of our roofing issues are. There are some issues internally as well. But I would say that the building overall is actually amazingly solid. The north side of the building has concrete reinforced floors. I've been in there several times. It's really good. So right now it's stabilizing the building by securing it, getting it closed up. Then next, we're also going to have some tuck pointing done, some structural stuff done, and really getting the site cleared off, because right now we have that lovely hump of a hill that now looks kind of like a mini forest. So we really want to make it visually appealing too. After we get all that part done, hopefully we'll be going for construction financing once we also have a tenant. So we're right now talking to potential tenants, and that's really going to guide a lot of the process. The beauty of a building like this is that we can do some really creative things. And so we're looking for a right tenant that also makes sense for this community.
When you say this community, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Kansas City community that resides really around the Crossroads and 18th and Vine areas, or Vine Street District. And to me, what that means is something that potentially has community benefit. Of course, we're thinking about medical uses potentially, or health related would be great. But we're also talking to schools, and we're also talking to different office users, some that are in the arts, some that are regular office users. But we think that what makes sense is what brings additional traffic to this area that wants to also be invested in this community.
What does that mean to you personally? I mean, can you tell me a little bit about your history in Kansas City?
Born and raised. I'm a native of Kansas City, born and raised. My mother's from southeastern Kansas. My father's from Mississippi. I have family members that were actually born in this hospital. And also, I'm a graduate of Howard University. And so going to HBCU that also has a medical school, and understanding that history and understanding the importance of having these institutions, especially at the turn of the century, that educated people and put them back out into the world. That's what really means to me. I mean, I feel extremely proud. Like I said, after I watched the film again last night, I was just like, oh, my heart. Because I'm a developer.
I just want to jump in and say it's called From Separate to Equal, of Truman Medical Center.
Thank you.
And go on. Yeah, you watched it last night.
I watched it again last night, watched it again this morning, and had a chance to talk with Kevin Wilmot as well. And then I also used to serve on the board of the Black Archives. So I knew a lot about the history in this area. I was taught it as a child, not in school, but actually from Horace Peterson, who was one of the founders of the Vine Street District as we know it in his vision. So I'm thankful for what he shared with me. There was obviously more to share. And so
what did he share with you?
Oh my gosh. Mr. Peterson passed when I was 12 years old, but what I recall the most is when the Black Archives was actually located about 20th and Vine, we definitely should not have been able to touch some of the things that we were able to, like Aunt Lucy's cabin, which I've sat in on multiple occasions as a small child. But he brought history to life, and he brought history to life that I did not learn in school. And I'm incredibly thankful because now at this age, I can still see his influence. And I'm thankful to all the people in my community that educated me about this. Coming off the StoryCorps, there are so many more stories related to Wheatley Provident. And we have a website, wheatleyprovident.com. Also have an IG page or Instagram page, same thing. We're looking for more of those stories. We want people to have those one-on-ones. Some of the people that remember what Wheatley Provident was are still here. And we got to get them while we can get those stories. But Mr. Peterson really taught me the importance of this history. He really refuted a lot of the claims, unfortunately, that we were taught. And it gave me pride in myself, and it gave me pride in Kansas City. You know, I've lived in multiple cities, but Kansas City has its own unique value that I hope we continue to uplift. We don't need to be like anybody else. You know, we have a great history that we really need to uphold. And I'm thankful to Mr. Peterson and to the many people in our community that taught me. My goal is that, you know, this story is bringing a lot of attention. There's now a post out there with, I think, 2,000 shares maybe that literally just got posted yesterday. So I'm in awe. But I love the attention that it's bringing, and I hope more people make a concerted effort to learn about it.
Can you tell me, I mean, you said that you had some, I think you called them maybe misconceptions or something like that, that Horace Peterson corrected some of those for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when people of color are talked about, especially post-slavery, a lot of it is kind of like, you know, uneducable, not able to learn, you know, lazy, a lot of different connotations that are kind of put out there broadly. What he showed me is the power of self-sufficiency, the power of our community coming together and proving all those notions wrong, and that in the face of segregation, not because of, but in the face of, that we could still persevere and that we can come together as a community to make a hospital happen.
Wheatley Provident means that to you?
It means that and so much more. I can't get it in this amount of time.
Erica Bryce is one of the new co-owners of the Wheatley Provident Hospital building at 18th and Forest. She is a commercial real estate developer, and we're looking forward to seeing how this all shakes out. Erica, congratulations to you and your team, and thanks for sharing
with us. Thank you.
You can catch anything you missed from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the hour, we heard some local StoryCorps stories in honor of that trailer coming to town. They'll be recording at the Nelson starting August 2nd. Tomorrow, fiddling in Missouri and the KU engineering students trying to provide global disaster relief through tiny houses. Today's show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Suzanne Hogan, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.